You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org. This is Capri Cafaro, host of Eat Your Heartland Out. I'm excited to announce a special series of episodes that highlight individuals that are both involved in agriculture and identify as part of the LGBTQIA+ community. In this series of three episodes, we meet an agriculture educator in Michigan, flower farmers in Iowa, and a fifth-generation dairy, grain, and beef farmer in North Dakota. Agriculture is becoming increasingly more inclusive thanks to the leadership of people like our guests. For the second episode in this series, I'd like to introduce Glenn Philbrick of Hiddendale Farm in North Dakota. Glenn, thanks for joining Eat Your Heartland Out.
Thank you, Capri. I'm happy to be here.
You're coming to us from the Dakotas, and it's a place that you grew up. And, agriculture has been part of your life for a long time. Why don't we start there? Tell us about your life growing up on the farm.
So I live on the farm I grew up. It is situated between Turtle Lake and Washburn, North Dakota. This was a dairy farm for most of my life. And so, I grew up with milk cows. My grandmother who lived with us had chickens when I was young. And so I had the privilege to eat everything we produced, including the milk, the eggs, the chicken, the beef, lots of garden produce, and much garden produce that was either frozen or canned. Years have gone by, the operation has changed somewhat, but I take pride in maintaining my quality of life around food.
I like that, quality of life around food. Now, you grew up on this farm, did you stay in the area or did you decide to come back to it?
I've always had my hands in there because I attended college at Minot State, which is only about an hour and 15-minute drive away, and then I work in education. And so I'm currently speaking from Standing Rock, roughly about an hour 55 minutes away. And so driving has always been a part of my life. And so I can teach and I farm. So I have the best of both worlds.
You certainly do. Those are two great cookie jars to have your hands in, all kinds of mixed metaphors right now. So it started off as a dairy farm. You said that it's changed a bit over the years. What do you produce now?
So right now it is a beef cow-calf operation, and the cattle graze. So it's they're grass-fed for the most part. And then I have some acres that are certified organic, where in addition to growing some things for household consumption, I grow certified organic vegetable and flower seed.
And what made you choose, these lines of agriculture, vegetable seeds, and then, beef?
The beef, of course, I grew up with. So I've always worked around cows. Even though it's not a dairy, I still have some milk cows. So I have milk for myself and cream, in addition to having beef. But I appreciate having that always available to me. Seed I got into because for me it was an opportunity to do something related to organic agriculture.
You operate the organic portion of the farm, but not all of it is organic. What parts are certified organic and what's not?
Everything where the seeds come off of is certified organic. There's also rangeland that is certified organic because I'm beginning to get into wild flowers such as Echinacea angustifolia, prairie rose, prairie coneflower, the prairie turnip. This is here. It's always been there. It grows. And I thought, well, the availability of some of these organically isn't really there. Echinacea, yes, but the others, not so much. And I thought, well, this is a good opportunity. Plus, it's there. I enjoy looking at them. I was just out on the pasture last night, and it's wonderful to see all of these wildflowers in bloom.
I bet it's beautiful.
Yes, yes. This is a really good year for echinacea and prairie coneflower and Maximilian sunflower.
What would the end use be for some of these things? I mean, I think most people are familiar with echinacea as, you know, kind of a supplement that I think helps with the immune system, if I'm not mistaken. But what about some of these others? You know, what would be the end use for them? Or are they just kind of part and parcel of, kind of the organic approach to the land use in general?
Part of the use is this is part of a diverse ecosystem that already exists. But for some places, they want to reestablish them. There are also home gardeners who want this part of their garden.
Right. So then you would transplant these then?
Correct. Or people could begin growing by seed. But both are an option. Mm-hmm. The prairie turnip is very important to tribes of the Northern Great Plains. One of my relatives, grandfather's first cousin who lived where I live, passed away 22 years ago. As a child, his parents would send him out in the pasture to dig up the prairie turnip, and his mom would make cookies from them.
Oh, wow.
And so that was my, as a teenager, one of my first, intimate exposures to native plants, because my cousin was in Minnesota, and he said, hey, we always dug this up, and he drew it out for me, and then I found it. So when he came out, we went out in the pasture, we dug it up, and then we brought it in the house and ate it.
Well, I mean, I think this is a great example of how land holds memories.
Yes.
You know, it's and so much of, your story is, and I think your commitment and joy in agriculture and raising the food that you eat and sharing that with others is part of your upbringing. And we had an earlier conversation about this off air. But I found it really interesting about how some of the ethnic influences also play a part in what you make as well. Why don't you share some of that?
Yes. Probably the larger influence on me ethnic-wise was my paternal grandmother who lived on the farm with us. She passed away when I was 19. So she is first-generation American. Her parents immigrated from what's now Ukraine. Her dad was a German Jew from what's in Odessa. And so I could see German influence and some Jewish influence in some of the foods. And one of them that I have very fond, two that I have very fond memories of is the grandma called it I Naka Naka soup. I, of course, translates to egg. This uses pickling spices that you boil, then strain the juice into a kettle, and you keep doing that until about all the flavor is out of those spices. That is your broth. And then you take eggs with some flour, but mix it so it's really runny. Take that whisk, and in the boiling broth, you whisk it out, and it becomes just little mini dumplings. That's one of my fond memories of grandma, and that's ethnically important. I know that the Germans like to claim that, but it's got pickling spices. That's more of a Jewish thing, which unfortunately for her side, for my great-grandfather, they tried to conceal that. And long after my grandma passed away, her sisters shared some information with me. It's like, there were hard times. They had to get out while the getting was good. Mm-hmm. But one of these foods is really important to me. Another one that's important to me is in German, it's called Käsesnäpfle, in English, cheese buttons. And there's various recipes. What I have fond memories of grandma cooking, and I did this myself, is take the dry curd cottage cheese, which is easy to make. I milk cows. I make cottage cheese. And you mix a little bit of egg with that, black pepper, chives, and then the dough is just a simple water and flour together, and you roll it out and put spoonfuls of the cottage cheese on there and wrap it up. And you have to put a little bit of water on the edges to seal it and boil it. And after that, you fry it to both sides in pork lard. Now, pork lard was really important to grandma. And I have to admit, it makes the best pie crust.
Yeah.
And so this is a fond memory I have of my grandmother. And this is an ethnic food. I've been to a German restaurant before, and they did serve that.
You know, I love these stories because, they show how much food, like the land, carries memories preserves culture and tradition as well. And, you know, there is a significant, German, Russian, immigrant population that has settled in the plains. And it sounds like this is somewhat part of that story as well, which I find interesting. Now, you can your own beef, right? Which is kind of an antiquated thing, too.
Yes. In addition to freezing, I do can beef, which is this does not meet, food standards, but, we've always did this at home, which was using quart jars or pint jars, taking the select cuts of beef. You don't want tendons. You don't want fat. And using canning salt and black pepper, and it's a 3-hour hot water bath. And it's sealed.
Wow.
And this is something you could eat as is or use as soup. But this is something that I grew up watching my mother and grandmother do. And I carry on that tradition as well. We've also canned pork and chicken.
And that's all basically for your own consumption, though.
Yes.
Now, what about what do you make for the general public? What kind of products do you put out that you sell off the farm?
So I do have beef processed for retail sales, primarily hamburger. And then a lot of beef is, of course, so most beef is sold in sales ring, but I've used a licensed facility so I can sell direct to consumer. Then I have my seed, and if I have excess carrots, onions, things like that, I sell those. That's a direct to consumer sale.
Like at a farmer's market or something like that?
That's actually to people I know because they expect, me to have good carrots or good onions, things like that.
I suspect you do. I suspect if I were one of your neighbors, I would be looking for, your produce as well. Now, one of the things that I found interesting in learning about you and your work is that you've gotten some research grants over the years, which we, certainly we know that the USDA gives out research grants for a variety of different things, but you don't necessarily hear about that. And I think that that's something that our listeners might want to know about.
I've been the recipient of a USDA SARE grant researching growing quinoa and amaranth in the Northern Great Plains and seeing if it was viable to grow, what varieties could grow, and also what equipment does it take and market challenges. So in my first attempt before the grant at quinoa is in 2012 in like a 100-foot row, and then in 2014 and 15 with grant funding, I grew that. So I had about a 5-acre field of Burgundy amaranth, which would really stand out, and then quinoa. And so it can be grown here. It can be planted with a few tweaks to a drill and combined. Huh.
Do you still make that then? Do you still grow that after the grant, or was that really solely for demonstration purposes to see its viability in the upper plains?
It was for viability, and then I grew again in a garden plot for someone asked me to test out some varieties. And so I like to challenge myself and grow something new every year. And for those 2 years, that was my new thing.
What's new in the next year or two for you?
So right now, I'm one of the contract growers for row 7 seed, and the 898 squash is new to me, so I'm anxious to see how that's going to turn out and taste. Lodi is what I grew last year, and I'm growing that again for them. So that's one of the new things I grow. In the future, I do want to test Brix in plants. So Brix, B-R-I-X, is sugar content. And I wanted to explore the relationship between soil and sugar content in some plants and what can be done to amend the soil through adding something to soil or a foliar spray to a plant that's OMRI approved, that's organically approved, to raise the sugar content. Insects don't like plants when they get over 12%. So, for example, I have wheat that's 15%. There's some grasshoppers around. They don't touch it. I've had some other plants that have lower content, and they like to eat that. So this is an opportunity to do research that can help both organic and conventional farmers.
That is really interesting. Well, that I can understand the benefit of that for figuring out the sort of organic processes and trying to basically almost have a natural pest control element of increasing the sugar content to keep some of the pests from being attracted to it. But what about you know, if you increase the sugar content, and what does that mean for consumers that might be eating that, or even livestock that might be eating something this feed?
So generally, you know, if you're eating a carrot or squash with higher sugar, it usually means, you know, it probably will be more appealing palate-wise. Cattle, I guess I've never seen my cows turn down. Of course, I'm not out there grazing alfalfa or prairie grass, but I think the higher nutrition-wise, there is a benefit to the cattle. But taste-wise, I'm not sure. They like what they like. That they do, but I don't know if it's going to make a big difference palate-wise to the cattle.
Okay, good to know. I just, you know, I'm thinking, you know, people watch their sugar, are concerned about sugar content and things, and, you know, if you're trying to increase it, I'm curious about what might, you know, what kind of impact that may have on, you know, a human or animal that might consume that. That is so interesting. So would you get a grant for that as well?
I'm going to write a grant proposal this fall to study that for the 2023 growing season.
Interesting. So since we're kind of on the topic of, you know, organic methodologies, for lack of a better term, as a layperson, what other kind of methods do you use that are organic when it comes to managing your soil, managing pests, et cetera?
I like to, for crops such as cucumbers or squash, I like to use mulch and plant it into that, because that retains moisture and is a weed suppressant. If second cutting hay wasn't available, which is what you want for mulch because there's no seeds, there are plastics that are approved for organic farming that you would put down, cut your slit in, and put your seeds in or transplant. Another is crop rotation, and I use manure primarily for fertilizer. Green manure could be in there too, because some crops get plowed under one way or another. That's helped keep my soil fertile. Crop rotation is very important. Cattle are part of the operation. So at some point, they go into the fields and they can walk around, eat, do what they do, just as the buffalo did for thousands of years. I have, in my soil profile, I have a field that's I'm between 5 and 9% organic matter on my fields. Mm. And that's often unheard of in a lot of areas to be that high. And for weeds,
that's impressive.
Weeds are an issue for everybody. It doesn't matter if you're organic, you're conventional, but your toolbox is a little bit different. Crop rotation does make a difference. Winter rye planted in the fall is really good at keeping some weeds suppressed. And rangeland, I've made a point to making sure things do not go to seed. So, for example, last night until dark, I was out in the pasture looking for wormwood to cut. I've been on top of this for several years, so I have some areas where I no longer have that weed, because I make sure it never seeds out. Because if it blooms, I cut it, it ends up in the burn pile. So I learned many, many years ago as a teenager, I had some bad experiences with herbicides, and realized one of them being that, it doesn't work, at least on wormwood. And I saw resistance with some herbicides, and so I was, before being certified organic, I was doing a lot of things by organic standards already, just based on experiences. Depleting the seed stock of certain weeds does help a lot. Rotational grazing, it makes a difference with certain weeds in rangeland as well. In fact, I can see the difference in the ecosystem already. And I'm not the expert on that. I'm going to throw a name out there. Gene Govan, his name is out there. He's a Leopold Conservation Award winner. He's really good at conservation or rotational grazing.
I certainly have learned something new from all of this. You get a great appreciation of the technical aspects of agriculture and the added layer of organic practices. And I can tell you have a great amount of experience and appreciation for all of that. Before I let you go, one other thing I want to bring up for our listeners is your involvement with aspects of food sovereignty. as the Dakotas have a significant indigenous population. And it's my understanding that, you know, you've been engaged in some of those food sovereignty activities.
Yes. So besides agriculture, I'm one of the business instructors at Sitting Bull College located at Standing Rock. And there's been Jennifer Martell has written some grants, among others, regarding food sovereignty, or part of it is just educating. And so some of the educational classes they've had involve food preservation, growing or cooking certain foods. So I integrate a bit of that in some of my courses because that's important to everybody. Food sovereignty is something that, regardless of who you are, it should be important. We should know where our food is from, make sure it's adequate, and you know that it's good for us. Last spring, I taught a class on how to make sausage. There were no leftovers when I was done. It all went home with the participants. Coming up this fall, I have two different pickling classes, one with cucumbers, one with beets, another class with squash. When we were in the pandemic and we were teaching over Zoom, I did a presentation on how to make apple butter and filmed it in my kitchen, and it was uploaded for students to watch. So I like to integrate this because a lot of these things, you can get easy access to in the community here. And some people, this is something new for them on how to preserve food. Unlike, think of my grandparents' generation. This was, everyday normal life. My grandma had four freezers for a reason, and part of it was they knew what it was like to go without.
Right.
So that's a tradition I carry on. I learned from my parents and grandparents, but I like to share that with students as well and the community here at Standing Rock.
That's great. And it sounds like you have a lot of wisdom to impart. What a great story. And, I think there's obviously going to be more to come from you and your work there in North Dakota. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Eat Your Heartland Out is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.